folks that are watching either live right now or after the fact. So important notice. So this is, I've added this to the notes from lesson 137 from last week on understanding the King James connection with the Bishop's Bible. So it says, these notes have been revised twice since this lesson was taught on Sunday, February 21st, 2021, 2021 at Grace Life Bible Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. On Tuesday, February 23, citations from the pens of Gerald Hammond and Peter Ruckman were added to these notes. These quotes were read audibly during the teaching of the lesson, but were not part of the original written notes. You guys remember last Sunday I had some books and I read from them, but I didn't have that stuff in the notes. So on Tuesday of this past week, I added that stuff to the notes. I typed out the quotes and added them to the notes. Okay, no real big deal there. They were revised a second time on Friday, February 26, considering feedback from Pastor Richard Jordan. In the original teaching of the lesson, I noted Brother Jordan's assertion that the transcribed notes from Grace School of the Bible, manuscript evidence, term 103, lesson 7, that rule 1 was, quote, largely ignored by the King James, by the King James translators, I need to change that, the King James translators in favor of rule 14. And then you can see my citation of that on page 2 of these notes. I stated in the original teaching of the lesson that I had reached out to Brother Jordan for information as to the basis of his statements. So I quoted him on page 2, and it wasn't immediately clear to me at first what he was basing his statements on when he said them. So I reached out to him and asked him about that. All right. I sent him an email like last Saturday, a week ago Saturday, not yesterday, but a week ago Saturday, asking him. Okay. In the meantime, before I heard back from him, I presented Hammond and Ruckman as two possibilities for where Brother Jordan could have come by that understanding. It turns out that my speculations were wrong and needed to be corrected. Brother Jordan's statements were not based upon Hammond and or Ruckman, but upon Olga S. Opfeld's 1982 work, The King James Bible Translators. Okay, so here is the title page of that book. This is a picture Brother Jordan sent me. I have ordered this book. Hasn't come yet. But this is the book that he was using to make those statements back in 1983-84 when he was teaching. And this is the page in the book, page 88, where he's taught, where the author of this, Opfeld, talks about gives his opinion about the text basis for the King James Bible and the fact that they didn't really follow the Bishop's Bible, okay? Now, we know from our studies last Sunday that that's not accurate, right? We know that they did follow the Bishop's Bible quite a bit, and that they did follow rule number 1. We know they also followed rule 14 in their modifications, okay? So let me go back to this. So, it turns out my speculations were wrong and needed to be corrected. Brother Jordan's statements were not based upon Hammond or Ruckman, but upon Olga S. Opfeld's 1982 work, The King James Bible Translators. Now, looking more carefully, I should have known this earlier. I should have known this as earlier in the manuscript evidence 103, lesson 7, Pastor Jordan mentioned his utilization of Opfeld's work in the teaching of the lesson. So I went back after talking to Brother Jordan, and sure enough, on page 84, he mentions this book. I quoted from pages 89 and 90 further on down, where it was not immediately clear to me that he was getting it from Opfeld. But that's what he was basing it on. He was not basing it on, by all means, Ruckman. Therefore, I apologize to Pastor Jordan for tagging him with Ruckman on this point. Consequently, the notes were revised a second time to clear up any connection between Ruckman and Brother Jordan on this matter. Okay? Now listen, I can understand. I would not want to be lumped in with Ruckman at all by anybody. So I made a mistake on that. I speculated a little bit before I had all the information. And this is me trying to, you know, be honest and above board and clear the air on these things and make sure that you guys know that Brother Jordan did have a basis for his statement other than Hammond and Ruckman. Okay? Am I missing something? Any questions about that? Now, that said, in our email exchange, based upon evidence that I presented to Brother Jordan, he did acknowledge that he overstated the situation when he said that the translators ignored rule number one. Okay? And again, it's kind of hard not to acknowledge that they did not ignore rule number one when we have pages like this from a 1602 Bishop's Bible that have their handwritten notations in the margin that correspond with the changes that were made between the Bishop's Bible and the King James Bible. Okay? I also wanted to show you one other thing. I mentioned manuscript 98, and I did not have any pictures of it last Sunday because I didn't know that I could get pictures. But I went to Lambeth Palace Library online, and they do have some pictures of manuscript 98. So this is manuscript 98. You can see the stamp that this belongs to Lambeth Palace Library at the top of the page. This is a page, the handwritten note. So here you can probably make it out. It says, the epistle of Paul the Apostle to the Romans, right? And then it has the first chapter, and then here we have Romans 1. And then you'll notice here that there's a blank for verse 2, and then it goes to verse 3. Okay? The reason for that is, and I tried to explain this in the notes to you guys last Sunday, but it was maybe a little hard to follow without seeing an actual image of it. But so they made a few changes to verse 1, but they kept verse 2 what? They kept it intact, so they left it what? They left it blank in this manuscript, okay? So this is the handwritten manuscript that I was referring to. So there are two of these documents. One of them is Bot 1602, and that is the handwritten copy of the Bishop's Bible that we see here in these images. How many of you saw my Facebook post this week where I took a picture of a verse in 2 Samuel 17, verse 3 from this document, and I took a picture of 2 Samuel 17, verse 3 from the 1611 King James Bible so that you could compare them? And what was fascinating about comparing that image is that when you look at, in fact, instead of just chatting about that, I should just go to Facebook and show you what I'm talking about, because I think it's definitely pertinent here to what we're discussing. Have I said yet that I really like this technology? I mean, I think it's pretty cool that you can actually call this stuff up and show people. So there we are live right there. That's us. Everybody wave and say hi. That's the lesson that we're on right now. But this is what I'm talking about. This post from the 25th. So rule number one. So here's what I said. Sunday, February 21st, I taught on the connection between the bishops and King James Bibles. In lesson 137, I sought to demonstrate how the 1602 Bishop's Bible served as the base text for the King James. There's a document in the Bodleian Library at Oxford known as Bod 1602. This document is a 1602 Bishop's Bible with the handwritten notes of the King James translators recording their alteration of the bishop's text. Consider the following example from 2 Samuel 17:3. And then I've got three images here. We're just going to look at image 2 and image 3. So here's the first image. Here's the second image. So I took this picture off of the Bodleian website, where you can actually look at some parts of the document. Thank you. So here's verse 3. So there's the insertion of the word I after the word and. And then notice that this is crossed out. And then notice that this whole section here is crossed out. And this is crossed out. So this is the 1602 Bishop's Bible. These are the handwritten notes of the translators altering the Bishop's Bible, okay? Now watch what happens when we compare that then with the King James. So here's the 1611. That's kind of small, so let me see if I can make that bigger. Notice there's an I in between the and will, and all of that text that was crossed out is missing because that was their notation that they didn't think that needed to what? To be in the verse. Okay? So you can literally see the process as it's happening by taking these documents, whether we're talking about Bod 1602 at the Bodleian Library, or whether we're talking about Manuscript 98 at the Lambeth Palace Library, and see what they were doing and how they were taking the bishop's Bible and how they were transforming it into what would ultimately be the King James Bible. Okay? And they do that based upon, so is rule number one to follow the bishop's Bible clearly followed?
Yes.
Is rule 14 to alter the bishop's Bible in light of Tyndall and Coverdale and the Great Bible and the Geneva Bible, was that clearly also followed? Yes. Okay? So, I just needed to clear all that up because it's not fair for me to tag Pastor Jordan with Ruckman. And so I do want to just make sure that I said that and made sure that everybody was clear on a few of those things, okay? So does anybody have any questions about all that before we move on? And again, Brother Jordan has told me in our email that he is conceding that he overstated that by saying they ignored rule number one. But again, this goes to the point, right? Back then, were these documents that I just showed you very well known by King James advocates outside of Great Britain or outside of academia, if you will? The answer is no. All right. And so when that King James only train left the station in America in the 1950s and 60s, it did so without a working knowledge and understanding of the two documents here that we've been looking at. Again, those would be this one right here, Bod 1602, and also Manuscript 98. Now, we're sitting here right now in Grand Rapids, Michigan, using the internet and actually looking at the documents. Could anybody do that in 1983?
No.
No. So, unless you were aware of what was going on in academia and what was being researched across the pond, if you will, the King James only train is leaving the station without a working knowledge of this information that we're actually able to see now here because of the technology that we have available to us. So, all that said, hopefully we actually learned something through all that too, but does anybody have any questions or comments before we actually get into today's lesson? All right, so let's get to lesson 138 then. So, page one, introduction. And so again, the title of today's is lesson 138, the Bishop's Bible, Understanding the Elizabethan Context. Introduction. Last week in lesson 137, we began our discussion of the Bishop's Bible by establishing that the 1602 edition of this text served as the base text for the authorized version of 1611. This is evidenced most strongly by the existence of a bound copy of a 1602 Bishop's Bible in the Bodleian Library, possessing the handwritten notes of the translators in the margin. So again, that's that document right there. Okay? Known as Bod 1602, this document, along with Manuscript 98, that's this document right here, Manuscript 98, in Lambeth Palace, serves as strong primary evidence of the process used by the King James translators between 1604 and 1611. This evidence was almost wholly unknown to the founders of the American King James only movement in the 1950s and 60s. Ignorance of this evidence caused prominent King James advocates such as Dr. Peter S. Ruckman, among others, to claim that the King James translators ignored the Bishop's Bible and thereby did not adhere to Rule 1. The evidence furnished via Bod 1602 and Manuscript 98 makes it clear that such speculations on the part of Ruckman are ahistorical and completely false. In this lesson, we want to understand the factors that gave rise to the decision to translate the Bishop's Bible. Why did the bishops of the Church of England see fit to produce yet another English version when the Geneva Bible was so popular among English-speaking people? Okay? So we've studied that already, right? What was the most popular Bible among the people? It was the Geneva, right? So that should raise the question then, well then why was the Geneva Bible not good enough for these Anglican bishops to precipitate them now making yet another translation that would then serve as the base text for the King James. So, the religious context of Elizabethan England is the next point. Recall from previous lessons that Queen Elizabeth ascended the English throne in 1558, following the death of her half-sister, Mary I, in November 1558. So remember that Mary I is Bloody Mary. Okay? Mary's death signaled that it was safe for English exiles to return home from their places of continental refuge. Recall that a group stayed behind in Geneva, Switzerland, to finish the complete Geneva Bible that was published in 1560. Also remember that the 1560 Geneva Bible included an epistle dedicatory to Queen Elizabeth in the prefatory material that was quite forward in tone and tenor. The following from Gerald Hammond's The Making of the English Bible was quoted in Lesson 133 when discussing this matter. So we're going to look at this again. So this is the quote. So this is a quote about the preliminary matter, the preliminary material that's in a 1560 Geneva Bible. The preliminary matter to the first editions begins with an epistle to Elizabeth. Queen for little more than a year, she is treated to an exhortation from her, quote, humble subjects of the English church at Geneva as to how she should rebuild her country. So are they kind of like telling her what to do here? Yep. They really are. We already saw this, so I'm asking you to recall this, but it's very forward in what they're saying to her. Building is a metaphor which runs throughout, and a parallel is plainly drawn between Elizabeth's task in building the English church and the building of the temple by Zerubbabel, when he was not only, quote, sore molested with foreign adversaries, but also at home with domestical enemies as false prophets, crafty worldlings, faint-hearted soldiers, and oppressors of their brethren. So that's what it says in that epistle to the queen. The chief foundation for her building is to be the Bible, the Holy Scriptures, faithfully and plainly translated according to the languages wherein they were first written by the Holy Ghost, end quote. Compared with the flattering dedications to Henry VIII by Coverdale and to James I in the Authorized Version, this epistle is a forthright document. It tells Elizabeth to wipe out opposition immediately and without compromise, just as any building needs to be based on the raising down of what stood before, regardless of the promptings of, quote, worldly policy or natural fear. If she fails to act quickly, she might well suffer the fate which those ideal biblical kings, Jehoshaphat, Josiah, and Hezekiah contrived to avoid, that is the, quote, wrath of the Lord falling upon them for, quote, the neglecting thereof. So they're saying, listen, if you don't follow what, I mean, this is literally what they're saying to her. If you don't do what we're suggesting, you better watch out because the Lord's going to what? Get you. And this is them, like, lecturing the queen about what she needs to do. Okay? And Elizabeth is finally reminded that she owes her survival this far to, quote, God's wonderful mercies towards you at all seasons, who hath pulled you out of the mouth of the lions, end quote, with the added comment that men have great hopes of her because, quote, from your youth you have been brought up in the Holy Scriptures, end quote. Okay? So, are they pretty forward with the queen here? Yeah. All right. So the queen is ascending the throne after the death of her half-sister, Mary. Mary, if you remember, was a Catholic and moved England back under the dominion of, sought to move England back under the dominion of the Pope. Elizabeth is going to be not Catholic, but very favorable towards Protestantism. And so do these guys see it as an opportunity to get everything they want? Okay. So, let me be clear. Elizabeth never adopted policies that sought to deprive Englishmen of the English Bible. That said, the religious/political climate in Elizabethan England was far from clear-cut. Understanding this historical context is necessary for understanding the factors that gave rise to the Bishop's Bible. So let me be clear about that point there as well. Elizabeth never passed any legislation or any policy to limit the Bible, the access to the English Bible to English people. However, she was quite pro-high church, pro-Anglican and anti-Puritan. Okay, and as we'll see some of that. And that's going to impact now the decision to make the bishop's Bible, right? Remember, the Geneva Bible is popular among who? The common people, right? The bishops of the Anglican Church didn't necessarily like that, and didn't necessarily like the fact that this Geneva Bible, with all these notes in it, was so influential. So we have to understand the context here that gives rise to the bishop's Bible. So, Blackford Condit, author of the History of the English Bible, has an excellent section discussing the historical context. And as you can see from the next few pages, I quote quite extensively from this. Okay, so let's look at this. Condit says, quote, "The reign of Queen Elizabeth was a transition period. In ecclesiastical affairs, nothing was settled. The short reign of Edward VI gave an impetus to Protestant principles which bade fair to decide the question of supremacy between the old and the new learning. A serious check, however, was given to this progress by the short but fierce reign of Queen Mary. But now the friends of the Reformation looked upon the ascension of Elizabeth with joy and heartfelt relief. Protestantism just returned from exile is stronger in its convictions and broader in its designs. Abroad, it came into contact with men and ideas, and by such contact gained in self-respect. While at home, it had been tried in the first, and I think that should say fire. Not first, so I need to check that. It had been tried in the fire and thereby purified and made stronger." So let me comment about that first paragraph there, okay, just briefly, okay? These guys translating the Geneva Bible, they're in Geneva, Switzerland. Are they rubbing elbows and shoulders with Calvin and Beza and all the great leaders of the continental Protestant movement? Okay? So are they influenced by the leading lights of the Protestant movement, and now they're going to come home to England, and are they going to have expectations now about what's going to happen now that Mary's out of the picture? And you can see that by what they said in the epistle dedicatory. So at home, the Protestants have been tried by fire. Remember, Mary the First, Bloody Mary, executed 300 Protestants in 5 years, burnt them at the stake. Right? So that was happening. Now these guys that went overseas, whether they settled in Germany or Switzerland, have they been influenced by the Lutheran movement and Luther and Melanchthon in Germany or Calvin and Beza in Switzerland, right? And now they're coming home, and do they have certain expectations of what this thing is going to look like now under Elizabeth? Okay?
How many people are we talking?
We're talking... It's hard to say for sure if you count the kids, but we're probably easy 1,500 to 3,000 people. And we're not talking about...
Not just elites now, or the scholars of the Bible.
A lot of them are the learned folks that fled Mary's wrath. So, percentage-wise, this group of Englishmen and families that are now coming home are coming from the most devout Protestant, they're coming back with the most devout Protestant convictions of anyone probably in England at the time. And so they have certain expectations now of the Queen. So, at first the Reformers were overconfident in respect to the friendship of Elizabeth. And then I added in here to the quote in brackets, "The epistle dedicatory in the 1560 Geneva Bible is a clear example of my opinion of their overconfidence." I mean, they're telling her what to do. All right? "They attempted radical changes, such as, quote, to set up King Edward's service, to pull down images, and to affront the priests. But in this, they met with an effectual check from the Queen, who, though slow in developing her policy, soon made it evident that not even the English Church, much less the Genevan party, had anything to expect from her by way of partial favors. So, is she still the queen? And is she going to make it clear, you guys don't call the shots, I do? Okay? Passing between the extremes of Edward and Mary, she followed the ecclesiastical policy of her royal father, thinking by a middle course to reconcile opposing parties. Okay? So let me explain. So on one hand, do you have the Anglican, the bishops of the Anglican Church, and on the other hand, do you have the Puritans? What she's going to try to do is strike a middle what? A middle path between the extreme of the high church Anglican bishops and the extreme Puritans. You following that? So she's going to try to walk the middle between them. She insisted, bottom of the page, she insisted, however, that there should be no persecution for opinion's sake, that the consciences of all should be respected. So we have to give her props here, right? She's not going to persecute people for not agreeing. But she's also not going to adopt official royal policy that necessarily is way favoring one group over what? The other. Okay? So she's really trying to kind of walk that middle line, if you will. The two great ideals of Queen Elizabeth, top page 3, were order in the state and uniformity in the church. And the latter, contrary to her boasted respect for the individual's conscience, was to be enforced for the sake of the former. During the reign of Henry VIII, the church was made the child of the state, and political considerations ruled in ecclesiastical affairs. So under Elizabeth, though she refused spiritual supremacy in form and title, yet held the bishops and deans subject to her royal will. She berated them to their faces, and in writing to them threatened to unfrock them if they did not comply with her requests. Dead to religious convictions, serious controversies in religion had no interest to her. Okay? So she's a politician. So to the extent that she can maintain peace in England, is she willing to do whatever she thinks is necessary? Okay? Everybody with me so far? The Reformation in England might have been thorough and evangelical had it not been for Queen Elizabeth. There was, on the part of leaders of the evangelical party, the requisite spirituality, learning, and ability to have accomplished a grand work, especially since the people, weary of Marian persecution, were so well prepared for it. But Elizabeth ignored the power of the gospel and gave a decided disdain to the Puritan simplicity, determined to hold a part at least of the pomp and magnificence of the Romanist church. Her opinion was that images were not contrary to the word of God, and that the use of them in churches, quote, might be a means to stir up devotion, and that at least it would draw all people to frequent them more, for the great measure of her counsels was to unite the whole nation under one way of religion. So, the Catholic Church is pro-icon. Statues, the Virgin Mary, this kind of thing, blah, 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 right? The Anglicans, were they more Roman Catholic in their outlook than the Puritans?
Yes.
Yes. The Puritans hated icons. They detested vestments. You know, the liturgical collar that I'm so conspicuously not wearing. Okay? You understand what I'm saying, right? So Elizabeth was willing to maintain that stuff for the sake of political expediency. So obviously this ticks off the Puritans. And for the sake of the established order, she determined, upon a compromise in things indifferent, to which both papists and Protestants might submit. Elizabeth held to the vain hope that the time would come when Catholic and Anglican, quote, could come together on some moderate common ground. Sounds like our day and age, right? But this forced unity only begot diversity, and this constrained order only brought forth discord. So from the beginning of the establishment of Elizabeth pleased neither party. So she doesn't make either one of them happy. She doesn't, the Anglican party that's more pro-Catholic, she's not Catholic enough for him. The Puritan party that wants more change, she's not what? She's not Puritan enough for him, right? So they're both kind of uneasy and dissatisfied. So let me just read that. To the ultra-Protestants, it was no better than Romanism. To the Catholics, or partial Catholics, it was in schism from the communion of Christendom, while the great middle party, the common sense of the country, of whom Elizabeth was the representative, were uneasy and dissatisfied. So no one's really very what? Happy with this ultimately. Again, may sound familiar to you, can't say for sure, but okay. What ecclesiastical partyism was rife in the time of Elizabeth. The Catholics, though under ban, experienced a secret but powerful revival. Priests disguised in, quote, serving men's apparel swarmed the north, and in other parts of England, though not permitted to preach, they administered mass in private chapels and reopened the iniquities of the spiritual courts. They maintained the Pope's authority and revived the ancient messages of, quote, commuting penance for money, compounding for moral enormities, and grinding the widow and the orphan by fees and extortions. While popery, thus revived, maintained its unity, Protestantism was divided, and yet strong, notwithstanding its division. So here's what's happening, right? You have a secret reestablishment of Pope of Catholicism. Yeah. At the same time, you have a strong Protestant movement. But shock of all shocks, within the Protestant movement, they're divided amongst themselves. Okay? That shouldn't shock you either if you just look around the landscape today, right? Okay? So, nonconformists grew vigorous by conflict. The Puritan was a sturdy defender of his bold and radical principles, and had it not been for his deep convictions and fierce energy, the English church party would have been swallowed up by Catholic fanaticism. So these guys did stem the tide of Catholicism sweeping back over England during this time, this Protestant faction, right? In the meantime, Presbyterians became a distinct party, setting up a new ecclesiastical polity with its corresponding discipline. They became, as it were, a wheel within a wheel, all of which gave no little offense to the state establishment. So that's the context of the bishop's Bible, right? So Bloody Mary's dead, Elizabeth has now ascended the throne, and they see an opportunity, these Protestants, they see an opportunity to really like seize the day, but Elizabeth is there and she's going to try to walk this middle ground between the pro-Catholics and the staunch Protestants, and as a result, she really makes nobody necessarily thrilled with her. Okay? But I will say, at the same time, is England under Elizabeth emerging as a world power? Shake your head, yes. It is under Elizabeth and Sir Francis Drake that the English defeat the Spanish Armada and become basically, and thereby propelling themselves into what would be basically the pinnacle power in Europe for the next 250 years. Okay? So there's a lot going on here. Page 4.
Is there any indication that we have as to the numbers of people that were involved in all these groups? Were they mostly Catholics or were they mostly Protestants now? Or?
I would say the Protestants still had they were probably the majority, but they were divided amongst themselves. And then on the other side you had Anglicans, and then you had Anglicans who were Roman Catholic sympathizing Anglicans. So you had a lot of different dynamics going on here. But again, to Elizabeth's credit, did she ever say, "You English speaking people, you cannot read an English Bible"? She never did that. All right, which her father did. He burns William Tyndale at the stake. Okay, her dad did that. So let's go to page 4. Dr. Donald L. Brake, author of A Visual History of the English Bible, also does an excellent job summarizing the historical, context that gave rise to the Bishop's Bible. Quote, Queen Elizabeth's ascension to the throne of England in 1558 brought reform in the church. Only five of the bishops appointed by King Edward VI survived Bloody Mary's reign of terror. Think about that. All of the bishops appointed by Edward were killed by Mary, except five of them. Queen Mary's appointments reflected her own survival instincts as much as her spiritual desire. Thanks to Mary, the Bible had been banned for 5 years. With Elizabeth on the throne, men and women everywhere could start reading the Bible again. A Bible in the British Museum records Elizabeth's words written in her own hand. So there's a Bible in the British Museum that belonged to Queen Elizabeth that has this written in the front of it. Quote, August, I walk many times in the pleasant fields of the Holy Scriptures where I pluck up the goodsome herbs of sentences pruning, eat them by reading, chaw on them by musing, and lay them at length in the seat of memory by gathering them together, that so having tasted their sweetness, I have less to perceive the bitterness of this miserable life. That's good. Elizabeth was a Bible, for whatever faults she had, she was a Bible reader. She read her Bible, she was aware of her Bible, and she read it in English. Church division and controversies were sure to resurface. Early in Elizabeth's reign, the act of uniformity was relaxed. As time passed, confusion surfaced, and Elizabeth charged Archbishop Parker with reestablishing the authority of the act. He drew up a list to regulate the services and prayer time of the church and to govern clerical dress. Rebellion surfaced as nonconformists took a stand, and the division between the Church of England and the Puritans widened. So that's what we were already talking about. While the controversy centered around church practice, the division spilled over into a fight over which translation was to survive. So here's where the church argument now becomes a Bible version issue, a translational issue. Elizabeth's desire to maintain a stronghold on her sovereignty forced her to seek the support of Protestants. Her support of the Protestant Bible gained Elizabeth widespread approval. Although not giving official sanction, she apparently was willing to be hailed as a patron of the Bible. So Elizabeth is shrewd. Okay, I don't remember if I mentioned it here, but she grants a printer a printing license to print the Geneva Bible in England. While at the same time, not officially what? Sanctioning it. Okay? Archbishop Matthew Parker initially supported the reading of the Geneva Bible, but later, as he became more anti-Calvinistic, he began to support a new translation. He saw the success of the Geneva Bible as an attack against the authority of the bishops. All religious authorities universally condemned Tyndale's version. Since Coverdale's translation and the Great Bible were not translated from the original languages, they were considered inferior. The widespread popularity accorded to the Geneva Bible after 1560 did not include the majority of the clergy of the Church of England. Although they recognized the superiority of the translation, the Calvinistic notes were offensive. Recognizing the inadequacies of the Great Bible, someone suggested an official translation be undertaken to complete the task previously given to Coverdale. So understand what's going on here. Is the Bible now becoming a political hot potato? Yeah. The bishops of the Anglican Church, they don't like the Geneva Bible. They acknowledge that the text, the translational text of the Geneva Bible, is better than any other Bible that was available, but they don't like the Geneva Bible because of what? The marginal notes.
Did they ever just delete the notes?
No, come on, Bart. That would be too easy. You can't do that. No way. I say that sort of tongue-in-cheek, but I'm also somewhat serious, right? I mean, no, that's really not something that ever enters their mind. They think, well, we need to have our own Bible, and we, the bishops of the Anglican Church, we should do that. Okay, and that's basically what's going to end up happening ultimately. So top page 5. After a discussion of the, quote, morals and manners of the Elizabethan age, characterized by, quote, the extremes of a refined barbarism and an overwrought civilization, Condit states the following about the English Bible during this time. Quote, the progress of this and of other moral reforms during the time of Elizabeth were traceable directly to the influence of the English Bible. Imagine that. Folks, just going to make an aside comment here. As we see the deterioration of our culture and civilization, we see a corresponding issue of our Bible being set aside. Okay? When England is ascending largely because of biblical principles being affected and applied to the culture. In fact, argued about bitterly. Not the kind of thing where, I mean, they're on this trajectory. They're on an upswing back in these days that we're studying now. We are on the opposite side of that. Okay? Yeah. So let me start that quote over again. The progress of this and of other moral reforms during the time of Elizabeth are traceable directly to the influence of the English Bible. Since 1526, the New Testament had been scattered broadcast among the people. And since 1535 and 1537, there has been no lack of the Holy Scriptures in the mother tongue. To the praise of Queen Elizabeth, be it said, that during her reign the people were free to print, circulate, and read the Bible as their conscience dictated. So I would say, based upon that and that alone, you know, she may have done other dumb things or whatever, but I can at least give her props for that. She's not obstructing the Bible to the people. Okay? There was an edition of Cranmer's Bible, 1540, which was the Great Bible, published during this reign, but the Geneva Bible was in the greatest demand. Numerous of the New Testament of the Genevan version, also of Tyndale's translation, were printed and put into circulation. In all of this, the people were satisfied, but the bishops were ill at ease. Very soon after the ascension of Elizabeth, they set themselves about the publishing of a new version of the Bible. The result of this undertaking was the bishops of 1568. Okay? So anybody have any questions about that? So, therein lies the political and religious impetus for the Bishop's Bible. Gerald Hammond, author of The Making of the Bible in English, states the following regarding this matter, quote, the Great Bible had got its name because of its size, a magnificent volume in Gothic print, clearly beyond the financial reach of any ordinary man or any body of men, and made to be chained in the churches. Remember we talked about that? The Great Bible is this massive edition that was chained to the pulpit in the churches. Remember that? So it's extremely expensive, and the common man really cannot afford to buy a Great Bible. It's just out of their reach financially for them at the time to do that. Look at the next sentence. The Geneva Bible was the opposite. Portable and packed with information, made to be acquired by the individual and to read at home. Parker's letter reveals, however, that even the churches were beginning to go over to the Geneva Bible, and the Bishop's Bible had to be produced to block that movement. So, what happens when the churches start reading not from the Great Bible in the service, but from the Geneva Bible? Well, for these bishops, that's like what? That's like a bad deal, that we can't allow that to happen. So we need to now have our own one. We need to have our own Bible. Okay? Yeah, maybe. So insofar, next sentence, insofar, lost my spot, I'm sorry, where was I?
It was over.
It was to be essentially a public version, better produced than the Geneva Bible, but nothing like so costly or forbidding as the Great Bible. Insofar as we can make such a deduction from the publication records of the next 40 years, that seems to be what happened. There was one Bible for the church and another for home. So what was the Bible read in church? The bishops. What was the Bible people were reading at home? The Geneva. The first had no contentious notes and no public support. Its editions coming few and far between. The second, which would be the Geneva, right? The second was constantly reprinted and held the public affection. So now do we have two Bibles here, ultimately. So in the next lesson we'll discuss Archbishop Matthew Parker and the decision to translate the Bishop's Bible, and we'll look at the process that they used. But I want to go back and make sure we understand something before we quit. So, Tyndale, I've said this before, right? Tyndale publishes New Testaments in 1526, 1534, and 1535. He publishes the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament, in 1530. Then does he do more work that never gets printed during his lifetime? All right. John Rogers, a close friend and associate of Tyndale, publishes the Matthew's Bible in what year? 1537. Okay. The Matthew's Bible, the Old Testament, in Genesis through Deuteronomy. No, that's not how I want to say that. Genesis through 2 Chronicles. And Jonah. This is all the work of who? Tyndale. Right? And then the New Testament in the Matthew's Bible is all who? Tyndale. From his 1535 New Testament, okay? This Bible, this Matthew's Bible, is licensed by King Henry VIII. You with me? Those of you that have been with us, you should know this, right? The test is next week. likely story, okay? So the rest of the Old Testament then for this Matthew's Bible is filled in by Coverdale's work. Right? So then the Great Bible ...1539 and 1540. The Great Bible is edited by Coverdale, and it's a revision of who? Matthew's. So that means if Matthew's is two-thirds Tyndale, what's this Bible? This Bible is two-thirds who? Tyndale. Okay? But the Great Bible is too expensive, too big, too great. The common people can't necessarily afford it. So after the reign of Mary, Bloody Mary, and now Elizabeth is on the throne, and the Geneva Bible is available, which you'll notice I don't have up here yet, these bishops decide that they need to do a revision. In 1568, and theirs is going to be a revision of what? The last officially sanctioned Bible. So if this one is two-thirds Tyndale, what's the bishop's going to be? Two-thirds Tyndale. You with me so far? Yeah. So now the King James, and this is probably too low for the people to see at home, so I'm going to move this out of the way. So hopefully you guys can see this. The King James, 1611, Rule 1 says that they should follow what? The bishop's Bible. Can you see this, bud? Now you can't see it. Sorry, bud. Don't mean to discriminate against where you're sitting, okay? So then the King James Bible is going to end up being what? Two-thirds Tyndale. So this chunk here, starting with Matthew's, and again, remember we talked about this, in the ironic twist of fate, who licensed this Matthew's Bible in 1537? King Henry VIII, the guy responsible for martyring William Tyndale. Yet the Bible that he licenses in 1537 is two-thirds who? Tyndale. Okay? So what this represents, and this is a terminology that I've adopted. I actually discussed it with Pastor Jordan this week, and he said he liked it, so I'm going to run with it. This, Matthew's Great Bible, Bishop's Bible, King James, this represents the line here of what I would call Anglican approved. The Anglican Church is approving of all of these. Okay? Now there's another one in the Tyndalean line that we'd have to write over here, because it's not necessarily, it's connected textually with these, but it's not connected with these in terms of official state or church approval, would be what? The Geneva. This one, 1560, it's still Tyndalean. It's still from the Textus Receptus. It's still from the preserved text, but it is outside this. And really, what I probably should have done is I wrote Tyndale in the middle of this, right? Because Tyndale is really the fountainhead of this. So I need to make a better diagram. So I'm doing this as we're talking, okay? So if it stinks, don't get mad. But you have, so Tyndale would be here in the center, and then off Tyndale you would have this. All of these had Anglican approval, and then you would have this one that is still in the Tyndalean line, but it's never sanctioned, never approved by who? The Anglican Church, the system. The King licenses the Matthew's Bible. The Great Bible is dedicated to the King. The Bishop's Bible is done by Anglican bishops in this system of thought, still revising the Great Bible, which was a revision of the Matthew's Bible, which was two-thirds who? Tyndale. So when you get down to the King James, and the King James is two-thirds Tyndale, it's because of where it came from. Okay? Any questions about that? And the Geneva is still Tyndale. It's just never approved by who? The Anglican Church. All right. So any questions about all that?
It's a little confusing for all of them to be two-thirds. It almost appears like they're all the same. What's the two-thirds actually refer? I mean, this two-thirds doesn't seem like it's that much in compliance with Tyndale if it's only two-thirds.
The whole New Testament.
Okay.
All the New Testament is essentially Tyndale, as is Genesis through 2 Chronicles and Jonah.
So it's only the latter part of the Old Testament?
It's only the latter part of the Old Testament and the wisdom literature that were not ever done by Tyndale before he died.
Oh, okay.
So a huge chunk of the Bible is done by Tyndale, and we could say is quote-unquote Tyndalean, which is another word I'm sort of making up. But Tyndale made up words, so why can't I? You following what I'm saying?
But that part of the Bible doesn't seem to be taught that much or studied that much in our churches. So did that have much of an effect then?
I'm not following your question.
Well, I mean, most of our teaching is from the New Testament. So if they're all in agreement on the New Testament.
So the section of the Matthew's Bible that was not done by Tyndale before he died was done by Coverdale in 1535. And remember that he was not proficient in Hebrew, so he got his stuff from the Latin, not directly from the Hebrew.
Okay.
Okay? Enter why the Geneva Bible is so important. Because the Geneva Bible is the first Bible where the entire Old Testament is based on what? The Hebrew. So when the King James translators are working on the Old Testament section specifically, and they want to look back at a Hebrew, where do they go? They go to Geneva. Well, they rely heavily in the Old Testament section on Geneva, because Geneva is the first one that bases the whole Old Testament directly on what? On the Hebrew, because all of these were following Coverdale, who wasn't proficient in Hebrew, so they're all essentially translations of Latin into English. So really, you kind of need, you, because of the circumstances that happened, you kind of needed all of this to kind of sift everything out. Okay?
God's way of directing them back to the Hebrew.
I mean, I don't know. I mean,
the scripture says that God preserves His word.
Right. So, is God involved in the process? Yeah, I think He's involved in the process. I think He's involved in the process to the extent that the people that are doing the work are trying to act faithfully to the scriptures. You know, and there's a lot of things here, right? So there's, well, I'll tell you what I do not, go in your Bible, go to Psalm 12, 6 and 7. I'll say this here. The whole idea that the purified seven times argument, I don't buy that argument. Okay? Psalm 12, 6, the words of the Lord are pure words, as silver tried in the furnace of earth, purified seven times. Thou shalt keep them, O Lord, thou shalt preserve them from this generation, how long? Forever, right? When it says there, the words of the Lord are pure words, as silver tried in the furnace of earth, that's a simile, folks. A simile is a comparison between two things using the words like or as. How pure are God's words? They are as pure as silver tried in the furnace of earth, purified what? Seven times. When it says seven times, it's not talking about seven English translations. When David writes that, in whatever year BC he writes that, he's not talking about an early 17th century English Bible. He's talking about the words that he is in the process of writing as he writes that psalm, as well as anything else God had written or would ever write. That's what he's talking about. Okay.
Wasn't that considered just a standard of excellence in?
Yes, but what? But what King James only advocates have done is they've taken that purified seven times and they've said, "Aha, Tyndale, that's one. Coverdale, that's two. Matthew, that's three. Gray Bible, that's four. Geneva Bible, that's five. Bishop's Bible, that's six. King James is seven. Ding, 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 ding. That's the perfect one." Okay? Never mind the fact that Tyndale goes through three editions. Never mind the fact that Coverdale goes through two editions, that the Matthew's Bible goes through various editions, that the Great Bible goes through two editions, the Bishop's Bible goes through at least two editions, the Geneva Bible, as we know, goes through at least three editions. Okay, so that's not what that verse is talking about. But is God involved in the process? Yes. Of course He is. But He's also not involved in the process like, okay guys, you see that verse? I'm gonna put my hand there and I'm gonna make sure you write that verse exactly the way I want it. No. They're not inspired in that sense. Are they dealing with the inspired scripture? Preserved scripture? Do they understand and have respect for what they're dealing with? Yeah. Okay. So, any other questions? We got to quit though. Whoa, it's already after 10. All right. So hopefully that wasn't too boring to you. Next Sunday we'll talk about how they set up the process for the bishop.